from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a renegade Libyan general suspends parliament.
We have the self-proclaimed liberator, a former general, who is coming in with his own mercenary army and trying to take control of things himself.
The U.S. charges members of the Chinese military with economic espionage. A new blog focusing on energy and the planet. And is there a right to be forgotten? It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Forces loyal to a former top Libyan general say they have suspended the country's interim parliament after several days of fighting against Islamist militiamen in the capital Tripoli and the eastern port city of Benghazi. Members of Libya's interim government have condemned the general, while his supporters say that both the parliament and the government are no longer legitimate. Edward Uranian reports from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Sporadic shootouts between Libyan army units loyal to former army chief of staff Khalifa Haftar and Islamist militiamen gave way to a precarious calm Monday. Each side claimed to have the support of the Libyan people and demanded the other back down. The head of Libya's military police, Colonel Mukhtar Farnana, who supports Haftar, called for a new interim governing structure for the country in a statement read on Libyan state TV. He says that activities of the General National Assembly should be frozen and that a new interim government should be formed. He calls for the appointment of a committee of 60 wise men to oversee the government and organize new elections. The legal mandate for Libya's parliament ran out several months ago, and caretaker Prime Minister Abdullah Thani's government resigned several weeks ago. Thani's successor, businessman Ahmed Maitik, who is supported by Islamist parties, including the Muslim Brotherhood, has been unable to form a government, and opponents dispute his legitimacy. Speaking on Libyan state TV, caretaker Justice Minister Salah al-Mirghani deplored the violence and insisted that all parties to the conflict stop resorting to violence. He says the government condemns all parties who express their political views by using armed force and calls for an immediate halt in the use of arms from Libya's military arsenal. He also deplores the loss of two lives in fighting Sunday. The Islamic militant group Ansar al-Sharia, which opposes General Haftar, insisted in a video on its website that the general had entered into a battle which he cannot win. Ansar al-Sharia, which is strongest in eastern Libya, has sworn loyalty to al-Qaeda leader Ayman Zawahiri. A spokesman for Haftar, Colonel Mohammed Hijazi, denounced both Ansar al-Sharia and the Tripoli-based Revolutionary Command Center militia, insisting that both Islamist groups would ultimately bring ruin upon the country, since neither sees eye to eye with the other. Worried by the threat of more fighting, both the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia closed their embassies in Tripoli. Turkey closed its consulate in Benghazi and evacuated its employees to a local airport. Algeria withdrew its ambassador last week. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Stephen Zunis is chairman of Middle East Studies at the University of San Francisco. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty things seem to be spinning out of control in Libya 3 years after the ouster of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi.
And there was hope, of course, when a moderate government was popularly elected after the overthrow of the long-reigning dictator. But unfortunately, we've seen a situation where there are over 200,000 men under arms and militia that are not accountable to any central authority in a country of less than 6 million, and many of which are hardline Islamists who not only are throwing their weight around militarily, but trying to impose very strict interpretations of Islamic law in ways that most Libyans don't feel good about. And as a result, we have this self-proclaimed liberator, a former general, who is coming in with his own mercenary army and trying to take control of things himself. unlike Tunisia and Egypt, where despite autocratic rule, a civil society was able to emerge and thus, you know, lay the foundations, you know, for at least some democratic institutions. The situation in Libya, being a rentier state, being one that was dependent on the sale of oil and the totalitarian style of leadership of Gaddafi, has led to a very weak civil society. So there were some popular democratic institutions emerged in the course of the uprising in 2011. They really don't have much foundation with which to build a strong democracy, and despite the desires of the majority of Libyans to have that. And as a result, the vacuum has been filled by these armed groups.
Zunis says although the international community has tried to develop democratic institutions in Libya, there's a long-time resistance to outsiders dating back to Italy's control of the country during part of the first half of the 20th century. The world's largest democracy this week experiences a transition of government. After a total defeat for the Congress Party in elections with a record high turnout of more than 553 million voters, the soft-spoken, sick 81-year-old Manmohan Singh gives way to the forthright 63-year-old Hindu nationalist Narendra Modi of the Bharatiya Janata Party. VOA correspondent Steve Herman in New Delhi looks at Mr. Modi's leadership style and governing priorities as he takes charge of the world's second most populous country.
India's parliamentary election saw Gujarat's chief minister Narendra Modi's BJP crushing the liberal and secular Congress Party, which was not able to keep India economically apace of neighbor China. Over a decade while the Congress was in power, the economy created just one-tenth of the jobs necessary to keep pace with its growing population. The big question, can the next leader improve on that record? Mr. Modi is known for pro-business policies and has pledged support for two long elusive goals, a corruption-free government and universal secondary education, but he is criticized as an autocrat. Mr. Modi's party comes into office with enormous political power, able to pass laws without any coalition partners, and with the Congress Party severely crippled. That has elements of civil society wary. Siddharth Varadarajan, senior fellow at the Center for Public Affairs and Critical Theory, says they should be especially vigilant.
I cannot recall a prime minister who has been quite so polarizing a figure and who brings to power as much divisive baggage as Mr. Modi brings.
Critics contend that during Mr. Modi's dozen years as chief minister in Gujarat, his state waged a systematic campaign against justice for Muslims and other minorities. Varadarajan says India cannot have inequalities and social tension while hoping to maintain sustained growth.
One troubling feature of the campaign Mr. Modi ran was that he was often counterposing his promises of growth with secularism and saying, do you want growth or do you want secularism? Which I think is really a very false choice to offer the electorate, because a country like India needs both.
As India's 17th prime minister, the staunch Hindu nationalist will have to reach beyond his base and modify his style, says economist Part Shah, who runs the Center for Civil Society think tank dedicated to India's social challenges.
I do think that Mr. Modi is smart enough to know that you can run a small state in a particular fashion. You cannot run a 1.2 billion people large country with so many diverse interests and so many different strong personalities at the state level in the way that you could run a single state.
Observer Research Foundation distinguished fellow Manoj Joshi says the new prime minister, when it comes to domestic and foreign policy, will find it difficult to deviate from the government's primary mandate that goes back to India's independence in 1947.
More than anything else, and above everything else, beyond the foreign policy disputes, entanglements, etc., is this huge compulsion to try and pull up people from poverty.
Mr. Modi, who comes from humble caste and class, in his youth worked in tea stalls. Now his supporters among the masses, who gave him a landslide victory, are hoping he can deliver on his promise to serve them their tall order for achieving upward mobility. Steve Herman, VOA News, New Delhi.
South Korea's president has announced plans to dismantle the nation's Coast Guard after a poor rescue response to the ferry disaster last month that killed more than 300 people. Most of the victims were teenagers, and authorities are still trying to recover 18 bodies believed trapped aboard the capsized sunken ship. VOA's Daniel Scharf reports from Seoul.
President Park Geun-hye Monday said South Korea's Coast Guard was insufficiently trained for rescue work when the Sewol passenger ferry sank on April 16th with 476 people on board. In a live speech on national television, Ms. Park said with the Coast Guard's current structural problems, another big accident might not be prevented. Therefore, the president said the Coast Guard would be dismantled.
앞으로 수사 정보 기능은 경찰청으로 넘기고 해양 구조
She says the government will move to strengthen the professionalism of and responsibility for coastal safety. Ms. Park says the government will transfer the investigation and intelligence function of the Coast Guard to the National Police Agency and the rescue and security function to a newly created Ministry of National Safety. Most of those who died when the five-story ferry sank off Korea's southwestern coast were high school students on a field trip. Authorities were widely criticized for giving wrong information on the number of passengers and casualties, as well as a slow rescue response. Education authorities initially told parents the students survived the sinking, but reversed their comments within hours as the scale of the tragedy unfolded. Distraught and frantic relatives of passengers rushed to Jindo Island to watch rescue efforts. About 170 passengers survived, but all were rescued on the first day. Hopes for survivors turned to anger and grief as rescue divers struggled for days against rough seas to reach those trapped in the sunken ferry. The Coast Guard chief and Prime Minister Chung Hong-won were in charge of the rescue operation. Mr. Chung last month offered his resignation over the disaster. A teary-eyed President Park on Monday issued another apology, echoing one made last week to parents of victims.
그들을 지켜주지 못하고 그 가족들의
She says as president, she is responsible for lives and safety and offers a heartfelt apology for the pain people have suffered. She says the ultimate responsibility for failing to respond properly to this accident lies with her. But most of the blame is being directed at the ferry's captain, crew, and owners, the family that owns the ship under Patriarch Yoo Byung-un. South Korean media report the 6,800-ton ferry was carrying three times as much cargo as allowed under safety rules and made a sharp turn just before it began to sink. The captain and three crew members are facing manslaughter charges for telling passengers to stay below in their cabins while they themselves were among the first to abandon ship. The Yoo family is believed to be in hiding and refuses to appear for questioning. The family heads a Christian religious sect that since last week is blocking police from searching its headquarters. The family's company, Chonghae Jin Marine, is suspected of corruption and tax evasion. Some people have also blamed South Korea's culture of deferring to seniority, which has been blamed for past disasters such as airline crashes, for the high death toll in the ferry accident. But political analyst Hwang Tae-soon at Seoul's Wisdom Center think tank says passengers were simply listening to those who were supposed to know best. He says it was not just the teenagers, but also the adults who followed the directions of the captain and crew members who were the professional experts on the ship. It is a totally separate matter, he says, from the culture of deferring to adults and authority. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Seoul.
The United States is charging individuals in the Chinese military with conducting economic espionage against American companies. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder made the announcement today.
These represent the first ever charges against known state actors for infiltrating United States commercial targets by cyber means. A federal grand jury in Pittsburgh has found that these five Chinese military officers conspired together and with others to hack into the computers of organizations in the western Pennsylvania and elsewhere in the United States. The victim entities include Westinghouse Electric, Alcoa, Allegheny Technologies Incorporated, United States Steel, the United Steelworkers Union, and Solar World. This is a case alleging economic espionage by members of the Chinese military. The range of trade secrets and other sensitive business information stolen in this case is significant and demands an aggressive response.
Holder says the indictment alleges the suspects maintained unauthorized access to the victims' computers to steal information that would be useful to their competitors in China.
In some cases, they stole trade secrets that would have been particularly beneficial to Chinese companies at the time that they were stolen. In others, they stole sensitive internal communications that would provide a competitor or an adversary in litigation with insight into the strategy and the vulnerabilities of the American entity. In sum, the alleged hacking appears to have been conducted for no other reason than to advantage state-owned companies and other interests in China at the expense of businesses here in the United States.
Holder says the United States does not collect intelligence to provide a competitive advantage to U.S. companies.
The success of American companies since our nation's founding has been the result of hard work and of fair play by our citizens. This is how it ought to be across the globe. Success in the international marketplace should be based solely on a company's ability to innovate and compete, not on a sponsor's government ability to spy and to steal business secrets. When a foreign nation uses military or intelligence resources and tools against an American executive or corporation to obtain trade secrets or sensitive business information for the benefit of its state-owned companies, we must say enough is enough. This administration will not tolerate actions by any nation that seeks to illegally sabotage American companies and undermine the integrity of fair competition in the operation of the free market.
U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder speaking today at the Department of Justice in Washington. The United States has an overall economic output that is twice the size of China, but some analysts say that by other measures, China could, within a year, surpass the United States as the world's biggest economy. The so-called right to be forgotten is being debated after the European Court of Justice ruled that the internet search engine Google must sometimes, on request, remove links to articles containing personal information. As VOA's Kent Klein reports, it's a debate about which is more important, the right to privacy or the freedom of information.
Many people have something in their past that they would like to remove from the internet, says Glenn Gabe, president of G Squared Interactive, which provides digital marketing services to executives and celebrities. He spoke via Skype.
They went to prison, right? And maybe 10 years ago everything happened, and everything's still showing up in Google on page one, even though that they paid their dues.
At the Electronic Privacy Information Center, Executive Director Mark Rotenberg agrees with the European Court that privacy is a basic right.
You have to consider the ability of individuals to control the dissemination of information about themselves. That is, in many respects, the core of free expression, how we choose to express ourselves or not to say things or do things. That's, you know, what makes us human.
A number of U.S. privacy advocates disagree with the European Court's Google ruling. It's likely to limit the freedom of information, says Jules Polonetsky, executive director of the Future of Privacy Forum.
So if someone can tell search engines or news aggregators or maybe bloggers, that information tells us about some individual, that individual doesn't want to be found, you need to take it down, the effects really could be dramatic. It breaks the internet.
The European Court ordered Google to delete links containing personal information about a Spanish lawyer's 1998 tax problems at his request, because the information was no longer relevant. The right to a free press is specifically mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, while the right to privacy is merely implied. Jules Polonetsky says access to public information must be protected.
So it's a real blow to transparency if legal public information can be obscured simply because somebody decides that it's information they'd rather not be available.
But Mark Rotenberg says the European judges did a good job of balancing privacy with press freedom.
And what the European Court of Justice has done with this decision is to say, in effect, you know, search is an important service, but it has to be done in a way that protects privacy.
The ruling will be costly for Google and other search engines in Europe, but is not expected to immediately affect their U.S. operations. Kent Klein, VOA News, Washington.
The Washington-based think tank Brookings Institution is focusing attention on the condition of Earth by launching a new online blog. Planet Policy bills itself as the intersection of energy and climate policy. Bill Anthalis is a senior fellow at Brookings Institution who writes on climate issues.
We at Brookings have been looking at energy and climate issues for many years, and in the 12 years Strobe has been president and the 10 years that I've been managing director, climate and energy has been one of the institutional priorities that cuts across Brookings. And we've done a lot of work on it over the years, but we decided that given a whole number of things, including the growing scientific evidence about the current day impacts of climate change, as well as a series of both domestic and international policy developments, we thought that we should have a dedicated, regularly traveled space bringing together the breadth and depth of our research.
So you're talking about global warming, but what are the programs that have brought you to this point?
Well, we have five research programs at Brookings, going from the local to the national to the global, economic, and political. So we have a foreign policy program, a global economy program, economic studies, governance studies, and metropolitan studies, looking at state and metropolitan regions in the United States and increasingly around the world. And all five of those programs has had consistent programming on energy and climate change issues. And we decided to bring them all together under one cyber roof through the Planet Policy Block.
What do you hope this will do for the public, for your readers?
Well, a couple different things. One, start a conversation, get input from a number of different participants. It's going to be a blog that's open to outside contributors. We will certainly edit it and curate it, but we're keen to reach out to others and bring them into the conversation and demonstrate the range and breadth of this issue. I think Richard Gephardt once said that, had a great line about climate change, that the effort to address climate change is the most complex political transaction in the history of mankind. And what he meant by that was that climate is an issue that covers our energy is a sector of our economy about one-sixth of the economy, about the size of the healthcare part of our economy. We all saw how complex it was to do major comprehensive healthcare reform. So we would have to do that in the United States on climate change, but we would then have to do that in the other 192 or 194, depending on what you count, 190-some-odd countries in the world if we're going to address this global challenge. And we're going to have to synchronize it and do it in a way that not only happens roughly at the same time, but responds to the very different needs, aspirations, levels of development, and uses of energy in the rest of the world. So the complexity of that political undertaking is something that we want to use this blog to demonstrate. So we'll have people blogging about local metropolitan approaches to climate change and the global negotiations and hopefully a little bit of everything in between.
Is this something open to just the experts, or can anybody participate?
When you say the word expert has a narrowing effect. I think what we want are informed citizens who bring a contribution from different sides of the issue. So we'll be looking at technical experts on energy systems. We'll be looking at people who work on the politics of climate change. We'll be looking at people who work on the broad economic effects and also on the impacts of climate change. You know, as this most recent scientific assessment indicates, we are already seeing dramatic impacts. And one of the contributors is somebody who has just joined Brookings in Nevada. She is the head of the Las Vegas, or was for 30 years, the head of the Las Vegas Valley Water Authority. And she has been dealing day-to-day with the front line of climate change, which is the water-stressed environment that is the American West broadly, and the Colorado River in particular. So it's that range of expertise that we'll be drawing into the blog.
And how can somebody get to your site?
If you just go on to Google or Bing or any other of your favorite web engines and simply type in Planet Policy, it should take you to the link to get you to our site.
Bill Anthalis, Managing Director and a Senior Fellow at Brookings Institution. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.